I'm DeMay Roberts, Stage and Studio. We're listening to music from Felicia Lowe's film Chinese Couplets about her family's history that was affected by exclusionary laws directed at Asians in America. These laws were enacted in the mid-1800s and continued until 1943 when the Chinese Exclusion Act was repealed. Other Asian exclusion laws were not repealed until 1952. Two exhibits at the Oregon Historical Society focus on the history of and impact of Asian exclusion laws. We'll talk with Eliza Canty Jones of the Oregon Historical Society and filmmaker Felicia Lowe about her film Chinese Couplets. And in the latter part of the show, playwright Julia Cho joins us with her writing process and her play The Language Archive, which will be staged at Portland Center Stage on March 26th at 2 p.m. and April 2nd at Milagro Theater at 2 p.m. So stay with us. This is Stage and Studio. I'm DeMay Roberts, and the music just ran out. But hey, it's International Women's Day all day here at KBOO, and we're celebrating women. And it seemed apropos to talk with Eliza Canty Jones, who is joining me right now live. Hello, Eliza.
Good morning, and happy International Women's Day.
There we go. All women all day long. What other station is going to do that? It's KBOO. And so, Eliza, you're the editor of the Oregon Historical Quarterly and director of community engagement at the Oregon Historical Society. And I think these two exhibits that you have are so timely and so, especially in light of recent events, and it's so needed, and the education is just utmost. It's about Chinese American exclusion / inclusion. It's a national exhibit on loan from the New York Historical Society, and this exhibit will make its only West Coast appearance here in Portland before it goes to China for display. Yeah, I think that's phenomenal. Can you tell us about, you know, how that happened and why it's here in Portland?
Yeah, well, I think it's important that you say that these exhibits are incredibly relevant right now. We're seeing these conversations happen in our politics. We're seeing them happen personally. And we would love for these stories to be some kind of crazy, long-lost reality that it's difficult to even imagine. But unfortunately, there are discussions about these kinds of things that are still ongoing in our politics today. So we're pleased to be able to offer historical context that really is necessary. And the exhibits in many ways came because of the work of community members here in Portland and here in Oregon. So Dr. Jackie Peterson-Loomis, who is retired from Washington State University, Vancouver, has been working with the Chinese community and the Old Town, Chinatown, Japantown community for many, many years, well over a decade. And she became aware of the exhibit that was going to be happening at New York Historical Society and that it would be traveling. And she and community members got together with the Oregon Historical Society and urged us to host the national exhibit. And then they have created, with our partnership, a really stunning local exhibit, Beyond the Gate, a tale of Portland's historic Chinatowns.
Well, we'll talk about that soon, but tell us what you can experience from the national exhibit.
It's amazing, and it's really worth taking your time to go and see this exhibit. And just a quick reminder, all Multnomah County residents have free admission to the Oregon Historical Society Museum and Research Library, and that's in thanks for property tax, a modest levy that Multnomah County residents support us with, and also will be free to everyone this coming Saturday. So quick reminders.
It's Smithsonian Day, right?
It's Smithsonian Day, and we are celebrating the opening of Beyond the Gate, so we like to throw the doors open as much as possible. So this national exhibit, it really tells the history of the relationship between the United States federal government and Chinese peoples who have immigrated here and come to the United States. This is a very complicated history. The first Exclusionary Act came into place in 1882 in the United States, and there were extensions, and then finally, as you noted, we finally got rid of that.
Well, some of them were repealed at different times.
Yes. And it was complicated because there were merchants were allowed in. So it's a very class-based policy. Merchants were allowed in, but laborers were not. There were some exceptions for family members. There are histories that you will hear a lot of community members tell about what they call paper sons. So the work that people did to try and hold communities together, hold businesses together, maintain their wealth and their access to being able to go back and forth from China to work with and, frankly, around these laws.
Well, you know, it was circumventing laws that were basically unfair because it was based on race.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
and we're seeing some of that kind of come with the Syrian refugees. And, you know, I mean, it keeps coming full circle, doesn't it? So this exhibit is so timely right now.
It's such an important way to understand United States history and Oregon history, really the history of the West and the way that labor built the resettlement of the West as it became resettled by newcomers, not indigenous folks who, of course, had settled the place for 10, 15,000 years already. And so this labor by Chinese laborers were folks who built railroads, mined gold, yeah. ran laundries.
And were used basically, you know, in gardening, built up the farming industry, you know, in the farming practices in the West. And then basically these laws said you can't bring your family members and, you know, right. if you go home, you can't come back.
Lots of exclusion of women. Yeah. Lots of that. And so you see that the National Exhibit, one of the most, I think, most engaging parts of it is there's a little setup as if you are in a in one of these immigration processing rooms, and there's a little desk and there's fabulous projection that takes you through what it would be like. There's audio and visual. So you can imagine sitting there being interrogated as people were. And you see an actual file come open and people had to describe their village at home. They had to give all of this proof.
Well, we have a clip actually from Felicia Lowe's film we'll play soon that describes the interrogation process. But that was pretty much for Asians, you know, trying to get into the country legally, actually, and being interrogated for upwards of anywhere to 2 years if needed.
Oh, absolutely. And that still happens today. I read an article recently about immigrants from the Punjab, Punjabis from northern India who are political refugees and are being detained for months and months, if not years. But I will say, for us in the history field, one of the actual ironies of this process is that we now have unbelievably detailed records for these folks. So people can go back and research their families with these incredibly detailed records that are in the National Archives. And we're going to be hosting several workshops in Portland and around the state about how to research into those collections.
Yeah. Well, in conjunction with the National Exhibit, Oregon Historical Society opened a second exhibit called Beyond the Gate, A Tale of Portland's Historic Chinatowns. And this tells the 100-year history of Portland's old Chinatown and from 1850 to 1905, and a new Chinatown, 1905 to 1915. I didn't realize there were two Chinatowns, so this is new to me. And that Portland had the second largest Chinatown in the country around 1900. I have to imagine that the exclusion laws had something to do with it not becoming, you know, with its disintegration and the, you know, less migration of Asians, you know, away from, or more migration away from Oregon with Asians. Well, you're listening to Station Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts talking with Eliza Canty Jones of the Oregon Historical Society. We're talking about two exhibits highlighting the exclusionary laws and time period of Asians in America. And for a full calendar of events, go to ohs.org, and you can see all the programs and exhibits, and actually ohs.org/events. And one of the events to celebrate this Saturday's opening on March 12th is a film called Chinese Couplets. The filmmaker Felicia Lowe tells us her very personal family experience with exclusion laws. And here's a clip from a film that describes the interrogation process Asians had to experience after the exclusion laws were enacted. And this was basically, you know, people were detained at Angel Island Immigration Station and other places, but here's a clip from Felicia's family's interrogation.
Reuniting her daughters was always in grandmother's plans. But for that to happen, Saw Kwan would have to get permission to travel to the mainland. And that meant another interrogation.
What are your names?
Tam Saw Kwan, no other name.
Where were you born?
I was born in Honolulu.
You are going to San Francisco?
Yes.
What do you plan to do there?
I'm going there to attend school. I don't know what school.
You want to go to school on the mainland, yet you have no idea what kind of school you're going to attend?
Yes.
And joining us via phone is the filmmaker, Felicia Lowe. Hello, Felicia, are you there?
I sure am. Thank you for inviting me.
And she's going to be in Portland to talk about her film Chinese Couplets, and it's great to have you on Station Studio. Chinese Couplets is the story of exclusion for one family, your family, over two centuries in three countries and four generations of women. And it's told through your perspective. And you cover so much, Felicia: immigration, citizenship, exclusion laws, Angel Island Immigration Station, the interrogations. I really couldn't think of any other film that is more perfect for this exhibit, to tell you the truth. It's such a beautiful piece of work and so personal.
Thank you. It was a very challenging story to tell, as you indicated, I tried to braid many aspects of this story, and I was inspired by realizing that the exclusion, which happened in 1882 and was not repealed till 1943, still had a hold on my family. That is, that because my mother came to this country during exclusion 1937, she came as a paper daughter and under an assumed name, illegally actually, circumventing these harsh laws, that because of that, she kept her life before she got to America very secret. She did not share with me the particulars of her life. In fact, she lied or taught me to lie from a very young age, saying that if anybody asks where I come from, say Hawaii, which for a three-year-old, even then I knew something was up, but I could never articulate it, nor would I ever know the real reason until years later.
Well, through the film, we learn about paper sons, or in your case, paper daughters, and how your grandmother had to buy papers to get into America from China. And you talk about the legacy that this has on your family and your feelings. What are your feelings regarding, you know, what the process of learning about this history? How did it affect you personally?
As you know, I've been making films for quite some time. The first film I made in 1979, called China, Land of My Father, was a visit to meet my grandmother on my father's side for the first time. My father, too, was a paper son. So our knowledge of our Chinese in America was very limited, certainly growing up in California as I did. I didn't hear anything about it. And yes, we did hear peripherally that the Chinese helped build the railroads and worked in the mines, but to really make a direct connection from my family to that story seemed very, it was a leap I couldn't make as a child. And the European history we learned of Plymouth Rock also felt very foreign. So in the scope and course of my work, which has been a combination of learning as my own history and then sharing it via the film medium, has really helped me become more knowledgeable and gain a deeper understanding and circle around to looking at my own family and how we were directly affected. And it's been through a process, actually, of understanding how, because of one law that said, you know, we don't want Chinese laborers, and created generations of descendants like myself of paper sons and daughters who, like my parents, didn't talk much about their past because of their fear that everything could be taken away, they could be deported, even though they had American-born children. It really created a community that was quite suspicious of government and therefore secreted about their past. And so I think I, among many others who have been trying to dig out our past by writing books, making films, learning it now in classes, in Asian American studies classes or at diversity classes, we're now learning a little bit about the impact of how those laws affect us as human beings. And in particular, as I said, you know, to really understand the depths of the roots in my family by going back to China, understanding not only am I first generation born in America, but 26th and 25th generations in China, really has helped me establish and understand that being American, I can fully own and nobody can take that away from me.
That's a powerful statement and a powerful film. And just to reiterate, the film is called Chinese Couplets. What are the couplets in this film?
Well, initially it was, you've made films yourself, so you know titles are very difficult.
Yeah.
To really try to capture the essence of what it is one talks about. And in a traditional form, Chinese couplets are two red banners generally. And if you read one line of poetry, it helps you better understand the other side. So they reflect upon each other and inform you about the whole story. And so in the initial was Chinese couplet, my mother and I, but there are many Chinese couplets in this story. It's not only about the relationships, my daughter to my mother, the one I discovered that I have with my grandmother. I discovered it in the course of making the film that she was a true heroine.
Felicia, we're running out of time, but I think it's fascinating, and I encourage people to see your film. The Oregon Historical Society is free to all residents of Multnomah County, but there's also a Smithsonian Special Museum Day on March 12th, and that's the opening of Beyond the Gate celebration of these two exhibits. You'll get to see Chinese Couplets by Felicia Lowe and a talk back, and it's free and open to the public Saturday, March 12th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society. That's located at 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. You can find out more info at ohs.org or stationstudio.org. And I guess it's just free for everybody that whole day, right, Eliza?
Yeah, we've made everything free for everyone on Saturday. And we're so honored to be the Portland premiere of Chinese Couplets. We're really looking forward to it.
That's exciting. Felicia Lowe, thank you for joining us and looking forward
to seeing
you in Portland.
See you Saturday.
Yeah, looking forward.
And I also want to, Eliza, remind people that Judy Young is going to present her slide lecture at 2 p.m. I mean, there's a full slate of events that whole day, but 2 p.m. it's called Chinese American Women, Exclusion, Inclusion, and Saturday, March 12th, that's Saturday, March 12th at OHS, and also she's doing a book and poetry reading at about Angel Island Immigration Station Poetry, and that's Sunday, March 13th at 2 p.m. at the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine, and that's located at 75 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. You got 30 seconds. Any final thoughts on this exhibit?
Just that I would say what Felicia's saying about the personal impact of this history is so important. And when you were talking about you had not known this history before, many of us haven't. We're very lucky right now that this community is telling their stories, and it's a great opportunity to understand the long-range impact of these kinds of devastating policies.
Yeah, I only learned about exclusion laws in the 90s. I mean, because it was not taught in the schools, and I'm glad to see there's some progress in that, hopefully, in the school system, but it's still surprising to most people that there were exclusion laws specifically geared towards race.
Absolutely, and they were championed by the leadership of the West. The Oregon leaders in the Congress were championing these kinds of exclusions. This is not just our national history, but really our regional history.
It's American
as well.
History, yeah, but, and also, regional history.
But people developed neighborhoods and businesses and did a great job even under those conditions.
Well, you know, you can't stop the human spirit. That's all I get to say. Eliza Canty Jones of the Oregon Historical Society, thank you for joining us today on International Women's Day.
Thank you. See you Saturday.
Up next, last week I talked with playwright Julia Cho via FaceTime. She's about to open a new play called Office Hours at South Coast Repertory Theater. I talked to her about an older work, it's not that much older. It was done at Oregon Shakespeare Festival in 2011. And it's going to have a stage reading here in Portland. So it's sort of the Portland premiere, March 26th at Portland Center Stage at 2 p.m. and April 2nd at Milagro Theater at 2 p.m. We talked about her writing process and also about the language archive.
I think every play is different. So what I've discovered is that I can't really dictate my own process. I mean, I think that I have this fantasy where I would just sit down and write every day and sort of write in this linear and orderly, organized way. But the reality has been that I sort of write in bursts. So what I was just referring to before, where I hadn't written for a while, when I finally did get around to writing again, it was interesting because Aubergine, which was the first play I'd written sort of after this dry spell, was actually written in stages because it sort of began as a 20-minute play, and then like a year went by, and then I sort of started expanding to a full-length play. So I would say from start to finish, Aubergine probably took a good 2 to 3 years of just gestating and growing and developing. And then right after I finished the first draft of Aubergine, I had this other thought for a play, and then I started working on Office Hour. And then Office Hour, I had been thinking about for a long time, but then I just wrote it sort of in like one span of time over maybe a couple of, you know, 2-3 months, maybe for that first draft. And then, of course, there was rewriting and more drafts. But it was just, even with those two plays, which were written so close in time, there was still like a radically different process where Aubergine took years, and then Office Hour kind of came out sort of more fully formed all at once. So it's really hard for me to describe my process. I have a feeling my next play will have, again, yet a completely different process.
I appreciate that, because I feel like any kind of writing has to happen, you know, when it happens.
Yeah. It's very humbling, I find, like the way in which writing always sort of makes me feel like a beginner.
I was curious when you started writing the language archive, because there will be a stage reading of that on March 26th and April 2nd. I'm wondering, what was the inspiration behind the language archive?
I think that the language archive probably began when I just first started reading about a book that was actually about languages that were disappearing. It's sort of one of those topics that comes up periodically, because every like now and then there's yet another article that appears in some newspaper or magazine about yet another language that is now down to its last handful of speakers. But for me, I guess that interest really came with, I think the book was called Spoken Here, and it's a book that's still around, and I read it. And I think that book sort of eloquently summed up the case of, you know, many of these languages that have been disappearing. And I guess that just kind of struck a chord with me. I didn't necessarily sit down to write a whole play about that, but it just kind of stuck with me, the sadness of that. And I think it also resonated with me because I had grown up in a Korean household, Korean-American household, but I don't actually speak Korean. And that in itself was also a kind of loss. So it was a different kind of loss than what the book was about, because the book was about, you know, these handful of speakers who were desperately trying to keep their language alive. And then I felt I had grown up in the opposite way, which was we all just kind of lost it. You know, like so many Korean-Americans of my generation, like, we just didn't think about it, and we kind of tried to speak Korean, but it never really took. And I guess we have the luxury of, well, there is a country that speaks this language, so it's not going to die out anytime soon, knock on wood. But I think that that just sort of fascinated me, that paradox of how easy language can be lost. And that just sort of resonated with me, because I felt like I had lost it quite without meaning to, but just completely, like, without realizing it, I had just lost this language that you would think that would have stuck in me, you know, given that my parents are both native speakers of Korean, you know. So I think that's sort of where it started. But I think that my plays generally come from very personal places where I try not actually to speak for anyone else or speak for a larger group, only because I think there is such a specificity to each of our experiences as well. I do feel, though, that if I write as personally as possible, that actually is the best conduit towards connecting with people in a larger way as well. So I guess in a paradoxical way, I just try to start from that place of, like, well, this is sort of what resonated with my experience. And I feel like the play then poses the question, does this resonate with you too? And so I guess I don't know, I don't think I could say that the play itself addresses that sort of larger Asian American community issue of language, but certainly it was informed by my own experience of being Korean American and of growing up having this language always in my ears and somehow never quite absorbing it.
Which part of Language Archive is personal for you?
Oh, all of it. I mean, it's funny. I think plays are both all made up and all real. They're all personal and all not. I mean, I think that they all are aspects of me. I mean, I think any writer would say that, you know, it's all personal. But there are, you know, certain, I think, when I think of Language Archive and I think of sort of that character of George and what he means to me, I think his monologue where he talks about the loss of language, that is, you know, one part where I feel like the play is drawn from that feeling of loss that I also had. I mean, I would definitely say that it's not good to write anything out of needing catharsis. You know, I think that's not always helpful. And yet at the same time, I'll say that what's been great about each succeeding play is whether or not the play succeeds. I feel like each play kind of explores or questions something. And then after the play is written and produced, that thing is no longer something that troubles me. You know what I mean? So after having written it, something is released.
So it can be cathartic in of itself, just the process of it, something happens.
Yeah, or something I think is processed, I guess maybe would be a better word for it, because it's not necessarily catharsis in the sense that I, you know, had this deep troubling issue and then the play solves it. It's more just that there's something that unsettles me or makes me wonder. And then through the process of writing the play, I think I get to a point where I make my peace with whatever it is that the play started from.
I just have another question. You work in television as well. So do you find that the, you know, TV writing is more accepting of, I guess, playwrights now? I mean, there are a lot of playwrights who've moved into television as well. Is it compatible?
What has happened is that television has exploded in the last 10 years. I think when I first started writing plays, it was still a little not bad to write in television, but it just felt like, oh, well, you're just doing that for money, you know? And now television is really exciting and varied. And I find television has been hugely accommodating to playwrights, and not just playwrights, but journalists, novelists, any type of writer with a story or a different experience. I think TV has really embraced. So, and this is a huge sea change. And what's crazy is the change is still happening, because now there's Amazon, there's Hulu, there's Netflix. So the amount of content, the amount of good writing they are looking for is just, I don't know. So in some ways, I feel like I don't even know how to answer the question, because it feels like the landscape is changing so quickly. But I do find, you know, you sort of, in asking the question of whether it's compatible, I think it can be and it cannot be. Because like, I feel like television is now such a varied beast that it really depends on what kind of writing you do. But yeah, I think it can be very compatible. And I think it's kind of a crazy Wild West time right now. So we'll see how it all plays out. But it's kind of a great time to be a storyteller, period, I think.
That was playwright Julia Cho talking with me via FaceTime. The Language Archive opens with a stage reading March 26th at Portland Center Stage at 2 p.m. and April 2nd at Milagro Theater at 2 p.m. For more info, go to theaterdiaspora.org. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thank you, engineer Janet Anderson. I'll have the show online later today at stageandstudio.org, as well as kboo.fm/stageandstudio, and iTunes as well. So you can like us on facebook.com/stage_studio, or tweet me at @stage_studio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.